Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Sandra Barrett, and on behalf of University College of Syracuse University, it is my pleasure to welcome you to today's program. It is a little bit of a recreation of a panel we did several years ago when the Onondaga Citizens League did a study on mental health in the community. So it's actually going to be interesting to go back, especially after we listen to today's panelists, and reread that report and see how things have changed or not, or improved or not. Speaking of the Onondaga Citizens League, it is, you remember that a few months ago we had a presentation about our most recent report, The World at Our Doorstep, on refugee resettlement. And I am pleased to say that the Onondaga Historical Association has an exhibit going on right now, and actually next Thursday, October 17th, from 4 to 7, there will be a reception about the opening of the exhibit, which is called No Place Like Home, Immigration and Refugee Resettlement in Syracuse. It's always interesting to go to the OHA, but I hope in particular you will go and see that exhibit, which is, of course, about the history of Syracuse. So that will be great. Heads up about next week. As you all know, we are in day 10, I believe it's October 10th, of the partial government shutdown in the country. And if you haven't been directly affected yet, you might be next week, depending on what happens. We are expecting and still hoping to hear from our Congressman, Dan Maffei. But if he is still in meetings and caucuses and whatever else, negotiations, Corey, whatever they're doing, tell him to get with it. We may not have him here. So we will then go to Plan B, which I'll let you know next week what that is, if we need one. So that is it. But again, it is the whole thing is very sad, and we won't talk about it anymore right now. The week after that, we are scheduled to see Chief Fowler. We'll be talking about issues of public safety and violence and in the community. And on October 31st, Regional Economic Development with Rob Simpson. I'll also give you a heads up on November 7th, we'll be talking trash with Ravi Rahman, who is the chair of the board. It's serious. This is serious business, too. Chair of the board of the Onondaga County Resource Recovery Agency, which many of you are aware that there are changes afoot. That's a facility that is undergoing some negotiations right now about its future. So it will be interesting for us to be able to give the OCRA board some input as after we hear more about what their thought processes are, what the situation is. Anyway, without further ado, it is my pleasure to ask one of our TMR members, Chief Esteban Gonzalez from the Justice Center, to introduce today's panel. And I also asked him to say a few words about the Justice Center. You remember the county executive talked at some length a few weeks ago about the proposal for a mental health wing addition to the mental health, to the Justice Center. So, Esteban.
Thank you. Good Thursday morning, everybody. Switch us around. I'm excited to be here, as she said. Sandra said, we have an exciting panel today with mental health in our community, and I'm very excited to see what my friend Bob Long has to say about our collaborative effort for an expansion at the Justice Center with our mental health beds. Without further ado, I'll introduce our panel. And I just drove probably a little above the posted speed limit to get here through all the traffic, so I apologize. I'm still out of breath, and I can... And I don't have my cheaters with me, so bear with me. Mr. Bob Long is the Commissioner of Mental Health for Onondaga County and Chair of the New York State Conference of Local Mental Hygiene Directors. Previously, he was Deputy Commissioner and the Director of Planning and Quality Improvement for the Mental Health Department. Has been a healthcare management consultant, CEO of a 167-bed psychiatric hospital, and worked in the New York State Office of Mental Health. He is on the clinical faculty of the SUNY Upstate Medical University Department of Psychiatry. Next, we have Dr. Narayana Reddy. He is chair of the psychiatric department at St. Joseph's Hospital, where he has worked since 1996 and also serves as medical director of mental health outpatient services. He was the Onondaga County ACT team psychiatrist from 2000 to 2012, based at Onondaga Case Management Services. And last but not least, we have Dr. Robert Gregory. He is the professor and interim chair in the Department of Psychiatry at SUNY Upstate Medical University, chief of psychiatry at University Hospital, and president of the Professional Practice Group. He is a graduate of Harvard's psychiatric residency training program at Beth Israel Hospital in Boston. And with a panel like that, if you have a question that there's not an answer to, there is not an answer to it if they can't answer it. So with that, I'll turn it over to Bob.
All right. Thanks, Estima. Actually, Sandra told me you were going to talk about the mental health wing in the jail.
whatever you need, Bob.
I thought I'd start off with sort of a high-level perspective on some of the things that are going on nationally and state level that are impacting our community in terms of mental health, and then leave it to questions in terms of getting to more specific detail. So what I really want to do is highlight five things that I think are having an impact or will have a significant impact on mental health in our community. The first, of course, is the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, as it's also known as. And the impact of that is largely twofold in my view. One is the obvious. More people will have health insurance. More people will have third-party payers, whether it's Medicaid or one of the other health insurance plans. And obviously that's good because people with mental illness and substance use disorders tend not to be covered by health insurance because the nature of the illness leads to the unemployment, leads to poverty, oftentimes leaves people either with no insurance or qualifying for Medicaid, and then the question is whether they're able to go through the Medicaid application process in order to sustain and maintain Medicaid. So we envision that more people will have access to health care as a result. More people with behavioral health conditions will have access to health care as a result of the Affordable Care Act. The other impact of the Affordable Care Act is a little bit more subtle and probably something that most people outside the behavioral health world wouldn't think of, which is that there are additional parity provisions in the Affordable Care Act for people with behavioral health conditions. Probably 10 or 15 years ago, the Mental Health Parity Act, the Wellstone Act, was passed, and it supposedly provided parity for behavioral health conditions so that people who had a mental illness or a substance use disorder were able to get the same coverage from their health insurer as you would for a physical health disorder. Unfortunately, the law was very limited in its scope, and people figured out ways around it, and there hasn't been a great deal of parity, and so there are still problems with people, including in families, middle class, upper class families with insurance, who face considerable expense if a loved one does need, for example, inpatient hospitalization or other costly behavioral health care. The Affordable Care Act extended the Wellstone Act by adding the elimination of annual limits on coverage, for example, by requiring more detailed language about what parity meant. What does it mean to have the same insurance for behavioral health as to have for physical health? The federal government has yet to issue regulations to enforce that, although they are supposed to be coming out shortly. And from what I'm hearing, they're going to go a long way again towards ensuring that people aren't arbitrarily denied insurance coverage when they need it on the basis of of it being a behavioral health condition. Excuse me. The second thing that's going on, and partly as a result of the Affordable Care Act, is Medicaid reform. Medicaid reform is a state initiative. There are actually several Medicaid reform teams, and I'm on the Behavioral Health Medicaid Reform Team for the state. And really what the state is looking to do for many years, as many of you may know, physical health for Medicaid has had mandatory managed care enrollment for a number of years now. So if you're on Medicaid, you're required to choose from, there are four plans in Onondaga County that serve Onondaga County. You're required to choose from one of those plans, whether it's Excellus or Fidelis or Total Care or United Healthcare. I think they just changed their name. So those are the four plans, and those plans manage the benefits. So they make sure that the services people are receiving are medically necessary and ensure that people get the appropriate level of service. behavioral health, for the most part, has been exempted from Medicaid managed care, and there are good reasons for that, not the least of which is that starting 20 years ago and as recently as New Mexico, almost every state that's tried to implement managed care and behavioral health care has ended up with a disaster on their hands. In TennaCare back in the 1990s, they collapsed their entire mental health system, and at the other extreme of that now, in New Mexico, currently, they implemented a managed care plan for behavioral health care, and now a year or two into that, there's all kinds of accusations of fraud and abuse, and people are being sued, and companies are being put out of business, and so there's a whole mess out there right now. So New York wants to make sure they do this right. The goal of managed care should be to get people well, and as a result of getting people well, to reduce the demand for particularly high-end expensive services like inpatient and emergency rooms. And that's really the way New York is trying to implement it, as opposed to the other way you can do it, which is manage cost, where you simply start denying care denying payment for care. And you can save a lot of money that way, but in the long run, it doesn't have a very positive impact on your community. Behavioral health benefits will be managed. The state just pushed back the deadline for that by a year, and it now will be impact. It'll start in New York City in January of 2015, and it will start in upstate New York in June of 2015. So we're not that far away from seeing that rather significant transition in the way we pay for behavioral health care. The third thing I wanted to talk about is health homes and the integration with physical health. One of the things that we know, there's two things that we know. One of them is that people with serious mental illness have a lifespan of 25 years less than the average individual. And a lot of that is not because, most of that is not because of their mental illness. It's not what you might think, well, they commit suicide. That's not the cause of death that causes people to have the morbidity of 25 years shorter lifespan. Most of it is a result of poorly cared for or uncared for physical health conditions. People have diabetes, people have COPD, people have a host of conditions, some of which are related to their mental illness, that cause them to die about 25 years younger on average. Health homes is an initiative, and it's a federal initiative and an initiative that's been implemented in New York State to really move away from having separate care management for individuals with mental illness, for individuals with HIV, for individuals. We had all these sort of boutique care management programs, and Lord help you, if you had multiple diseases, you probably couldn't swing a cat without hitting care manager. Health homes are really an effort to try to integrate that and to integrate it not only in terms of the care management entities, but also to integrate it in terms of looking at both physical and mental health care, because the other thing we know about people with serious mental illness or serious substance abuse disorders who have untreated physical illness is that it costs the healthcare system a lot of money. Just like with anybody else, if you have diabetes and it doesn't get treated, you end up in very expensive care. If you have other types of illnesses that don't get treated, you end up in very expensive care. And so what ends up happening is people with serious mental illness, because they don't get good treatment, and we could spend an hour talking about why that is, but as a result of that, they end up tending to use high-end services. So they're very ill when they contact the physical health system, and they're using emergency rooms, they're using inpatient care, they're undergoing surgery, they're undergoing very expensive treatment. So again, the health homes are an effort to bring those two things together. The fourth thing, and we were going to have Dr. Catalani here, but he wasn't able to make it because the executive director at Hutchings just retired, and he is now acting in that role. So I think he has a few things on his plate. Sandra asked me if I could say a few words about this, and I said that's easy because not a lot is known. The Regional Care Centers of Excellence is a plan that's been rolled out by the State Office of Mental Health. And in essence, the idea behind it is to shift care from a relatively large, compared to other states, number of inpatient psychiatric centers into more community-based services. On a concrete level, what that plan means, what is being proposed, is that Binghamton Psychiatric Center in Binghamton, Elmira Psychiatric Center in Elmira, and St. Lawrence Psychiatric Center in up in Ogdensburg, in terms of our area, are slated to close. The patients who are currently at those psychiatric centers, some of the Elmira patients will go to Buffalo, some will come to Hutchings. The folks from St. Lawrence and from Binghamton will be coming to Hutchings. As a result, Hutchings' inpatient adult capacity will be expanding, So they will be expanding into from, I think they're 105 beds now. I'm looking at Brian. And I think they're going to expand to 185 beds to accommodate folks who are coming in from those other centers. At the same time, the children's unit and children and adolescent inpatient unit at Hutchings will be moving to Mohawk Valley Psychiatric Center in Utica, because Mohawk Valley has space for that, and when Hutchings expands for adult capacity, they will not have space for that. So they will be combining what's historically been called the Pinefield unit at Mohawk Valley, which is 30 beds, the Hutchings program, which is 30 beds, into a new 75-bed children's unit. So, the capacity will expand, but it'll be located in Utica rather than half in Syracuse and half in Utica. And as a result of this plan, the goal is to reinvest resources from the closure of Elmira, Binghamton, and St. Lawrence, to reinvest those resources into community services. So there is currently a multi-stakeholder group. It's about 25 or 30 people. I'm not a member of that, who are meeting and are going to be in each region, and who are meeting and are going to be making recommendations to the State Office of Mental Health about how the savings from those closures should be reinvested in community services. Should there be more ACT teams? Should there be more nursing support, community nurse-based nursing support, those types of things, to address some of the issues in the community, both in terms of access and in terms of the types and quality of care that people receive. And then the last thing I wanted to talk about before I move on is that Onondaga County is also undergoing a human services reorganization. A decision was made, or actually the thinking started a little over a year ago, about how could we better organize our human services in the county in order to more effectively address the needs of people in our community. And what that decision has evolved into is a decision to reorganize. Right now we're organized, there's a Department of Social Services, which includes Children's Division, there's a Department of Mental Health, there's a Department of Aging and Youth. We're sort of organized by topic area right now. What we're going to be doing is we're going to be reorganizing as of January 1st, and this was just adopted by the legislature last week. We're going to be reorganizing as of January 1st into a Department of Children and Family Services and a Department of Adult and Long-Term Care Services. The Children and Family Services will include juvenile justice, which is now in the probation department. It will include child welfare, child protective, which is now in the DSS department. It will include the Youth Bureau, which is now in the Aging and Youth Department. So again, it's bringing those services together that serve youth into one integrated department. The same thing is going to occur on the adult side. Right now, at Children's Mental Health will also be part of the Child and Family Department. On the adult side, adult mental health, long-term care, adult protective, aging, which is now in Aging and Youth, there's five, and I'm always forgetting one. It's always a different one every time, at least. And veterans will all be, veteran services will all be brought into the adult department. And again, the idea there is that there's a lot of overlap in terms of the people being served by those departments. If you can imagine, Adult Protective serves people with mental illness. Adult Protective also serves people who are elderly and unable to care for themselves. There are substance abuse and mental health problems throughout all of those populations. So really it's an effort for us to come together and say, how can we better integrate our services so that, we're supporting people more effectively in our community. So with that, I will stop, and I will pass it on to Dr. Reddy.
Hi, good morning. I don't know where to start because there's a lot going on at St. Joe's, but I'll be brief and I'll take more questions because I'm not sure what you'd be looking for. I'll take where Bob left off. I mean, the mantra at St. Joe's is integrated care, and I'll touch on three points about that. I'm sure you're all aware that we have a new CPAP, which is integrated with the emergency department, so the care for emergency services is in one site. So the medical care and psychiatric care would be integrated, and both of them have expanded. The volumes have gone up, so we have more staffing, and we are trying to streamline better care for the patients at one place. The other integrated site is for outpatient services. We have integrated a primary care and psychiatry. So a person can get adult primary care, children's, OBGYN, and psychiatry at one site. We started out at James Street, our outpatient clinic. The primary care people are next to us, so we can just walk the patient out, take them to the lab, or see the primary care if there's a problem, because I think that works best. As Bob said, for various reasons, these people cannot get primary care because they're at a different site, they have to go to the main hospital, the parking is a problem, and they're not comfortable going to a new place. They've been coming to us for 10 years, and even if they go, it's hard to know what's going on with them. So we have an integrated care which started out at outpatient. And it's going to be similar in primary care. Come early spring, there is going to be psychiatry at every primary care center in St. Joe's system. So they don't have to go to another building and don't have to travel anywhere else. And they can see the primary care and psychiatry or a therapist at the same time, same day, one after the other appointments. So I think that would be very helpful, and it's been taken very well. We are going to expand to NorthMed, and we have other satellite offices where we are going to integrate the adult care, children, OBGYN, and psychiatry together. And the third place where we're going to integrate all the care together is, as Bob told, about health homes. St. Joe's is a lead agency in health homes. We just took off a few months ago. And since the St. Joe's has a broader spread, we have four counties we need to look at, and it's going to be a huge task. And these are all chronic people who do not go for their care, and so they can have home visits. There will be care managers who would be making sure that all their providers have coordinating with each other for the care. And Bob said it would reduce a lot of high-end expensive care in the end, and also hopefully prolong their quality of life and their life. So those are the three exciting things that has been going on at St. Joe's. As I said, I can tell you a lot more. I'm sure there are a lot more questions about these. I'll take them when I'm done. I'll leave it to Bob to take care of them.
All right. Well, thanks. I was asked to comment on the current state of mental health services, and especially as it pertains to Upstate. And when I was thinking about how to how to describe the current state of mental health services, I was very tempted to follow Senator Ted Cruz's example and read to you Green Eggs and Ham. I do not like them, Sam I am. But from my vantage point, the state of mental health services and medical education, which Upstate is very involved in as well, is really very much in a state of flux. And there's a maelstrom of converging forces, as Commissioner Long was describing. And I think really the largest changes in our healthcare system in decades. So with these different forces coming together and all the change and flux, it's really hard to predict what our mental health care system is going to look like in a couple years. So what I was going to do is just talk about some of these forces that Commissioner Long went over and how those pertain to Upstate. So the Affordable Care Act at the federal level is a big one. The provision of mental health care at Upstate has relied on federal monies called DSH payments to make up the difference for what Medicaid reimburses and the actual cost or true cost of providing those services. So it's unclear if those payments are taken away, whether the managed Medicaid and other kinds of insurance payments are going to be sufficient to maintain the financial viability of our mental health clinic and our inpatient units. Furthermore, there are a host of new regulations, federal regulations, as part of this and as part of Medicare, that have substantially added to costs, especially electronic medical records. There are a lot of advantages in electronic medical records, but the way they're set up, there are a host of requirements that have to be in them, and now we started an electronic medical record a year ago. It actually takes me five times as long to write a note in electronic medical record as it did pen and paper. Another federal initiative is really, and force it hasn't been talked about, is graduate medical education. The young doctors we train in psychiatry, called resident physicians, are funded by federal dollars, Part A Medicare dollars, and that amount of funding has been capped. And there's a strong movement in Congress to drastically cut or even totally eliminate funding for graduate medical education. Many hospitals, in fact, have already cut back on funding for resident physician training, including St. Joe's, which cut back, used to fund two of our resident psychiatrist positions and no longer does so. And now there's a committee in upstate to look where else in different residencies and fellowships, including psychiatry, cutbacks can be made. At the state level, Commissioner Long mentioned new regional centers of excellence. And upstate is very concerned about not having any child or adolescent beds in the community. The nearest beds are going to be in Utica, 50 miles away. It's going to create a very large hardship for families in particular and their ability to participate in the care of their child. And upstate has been advocating and with New York State trying to get capital money to build an adolescent unit here in Syracuse. So far, there doesn't seem to be much interest or concern in Albany to do that, but we're still hopeful. On a more positive note, New York State's Office of Mental Health has assured us of continuing support for our child and adolescent fellowship program, and that's been really important to help train child psychiatrists for this community. We were able to retain in New York State about two-thirds of the child psychiatrists we train. Second, at the state level, is all Medicaid mental health recipients, as Commissioner Long was describing, will eventually, 2015, switch to managed Medicaid. And as he was describing, it's really unclear if those with serious mental illness will be able to receive the same level of services under managed Medicaid that they receive under Medicaid. In other states, such as Massachusetts, Tennessee, and others, that transition hasn't gone well, and there's been a cutback in services. Moreover, New York State's contracting with managed Medicaid companies to oversee inpatient care and add many new stringent criteria for reimbursement for inpatient admissions. We've started to see that, and this again threatens the financial viability of our region's inpatient units. So those are some of the forces and some of the worries. I think the news at the local level and local forces is much more positive. I believe the local community leadership in mental health care is the best we've had in many years. And I'm talking about the two guys sitting at this table among many other leaders. And despite the tough times, they have found ways to expand access to care, as you have heard Dr. Reddy describe some of that, and Commissioner Long has been very instrumental, too, in promoting that, and coming up with innovative delivery models that are more consumer-friendly and recovery-oriented. And I think so long as we have leaders like this, and so long as we, as a community, have the political will to advocate for better funding on both the state and federal level, I think we'll come out of this all right. So I think questions?
There definitely are going to be questions. Thank you very much. Softball question to start.
As a member of this community with absolutely no vested interest at this time in the mental health field, contrary to public opinion. I'm very concerned about the children at Hutchings being moved out of town and away from a children's hospital, and I do not understand how anybody can think of integrated medical care when you separate patients from hospitals by 75 miles, to say nothing of the family implications of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a lot of us in this room share that concern. You know, to be honest with you, I think this train has left the station. I don't think it's feasible to prevent the program from moving to Utica and being consolidated. What I'm optimistic about is what Dr. Gregory mentioned, which is that Upstate has for some time had plans to develop a children's unit, and those have been stymied by a variety of things, not the least of which is funding. But I'm hopeful that this may actually serve as a catalyst to get that program going. Certainly our Community Services Board, which is advises me and my department, has taken that position, has written a letter to the state in support of that, and we're hopeful that there'll be enough pressure, if you will, to get that done. And that has other advantages. We've been advocating that since Upstate first talked about it back in 2005, 2006, I think, because the other problem was that there were certain payers who would not pay Hutchings because it's a state institution. As a result, kids were going out of our area even before the decision was made to move. We have about 120 to 150 kids a year who leave the area for inpatient psychiatric care primarily because of that payment issue. And they're going to Four Winds in Saratoga. They're going to Bry Lynn in Buffalo. Some of them are going to Four Winds in Katona down in Westchester County. So these kids are going much further than the 55 miles or so to Utica. So, you know, if we can get the unit at Upstate, if we can get increased community services, my hope is those community services will reduce the number of children who need to be hospitalized, and for those who do, they'll be able to get local care at Upstate regardless of who their payer is. So,
And I know it's certainly something that's been talked about a long time. Even when the Children's Hospital was in its planning stages, we were saying, well, why isn't there a psychiatric unit? But that being said, if there's anything we as citizens can do, let us know, Doctor.
Can I just add one more thing?
Yes, please.
We've been at St. Joe's, been working with the state for a long, long time because the kids are held up at CPAP forever, because even when the unit was here, it was always full. So as Commissioner Long said, we had to send people to Albany, Buffalo, Westchester because Hutchings unit was always full, and it's hard to discharge them quickly so they stay longer, and more kids are showing up at CPAP. So they end up being discharged to our outpatient clinic, which is not the perfect ideal situation because of lack of beds.
Absolutely. And for those who might not remember, CPEP is the Comprehensive Psychiatric Emergency Program, which is housed at St. Joe's, but for all the hospitals, kind of serves
right. We have a
the
nine
emergency
county,
room for right, the mental health emergency room. Thank you.
That's a segue into my question, which is, I work in supportive housing. I had a disabled resident who presented a window of opportunity to engage the mental health system. She was chronically mentally ill by my assessment, but had not engaged with formal counseling and so forth for her difficulties. I took her to CPEP. She was discharged that day, and then she was told when she called for the follow-up outpatient therapy, there would be 4 weeks before she could see someone. Now, my question is 4 weeks an acceptable standard? Is this off the mark in terms of what we have available in the way of continuing intervention on an outpatient basis?
Right. I mean, that's always been a problem, but because I think St. Joe's Outpatient Services is the only active mental health services that people can get into. I mean, they're all limited for various reasons. They're capped because of the students or residents. So we get from everywhere. I mean, from inpatient, from CPAP. We're trying to do it better, but I think it's a matter of volume and the staffing issues that it becomes a challenge for us.
Just to add to that a little bit, I mean, we have a total of 7 outpatient clinics in town. Some treat adults and children, some only treat adults. And 3 of them are operated by the government, that is, or semi-government in the case of Upstate, is one. One is operated by the county for children, and one is operated by Hutchings. And as you know, there hasn't been a big push to increase taxes and expand services. And so those programs are pretty much limited in their ability to expand their capacity. The other 4 are run by not-for-profits. St. Joe's operates one. Arise Child and Family Services operates one. There are other Syracuse Behavioral Health Care operates a mental health clinic. And who am I forgetting?
Brownell.
Oh, and Brownell Center at Liberty Resources operates a program. The challenges are partly financial, and that actually the state has just implemented a new rate structure, which seems to be helping. For the first time, our mental health clinics are not all massively losing money. They're only all slightly losing money. And the other thing, particularly for children, is the shortage of child psychiatrists. And as Dr. Gregory alluded to earlier, that's a reason why we're very interested in seeing continued support for the Child Psychiatry Fellowship here in Syracuse, because as you can imagine, it's easier to get people to stay in Syracuse once they've been here for 2 years for training than it is to approach someone in San Diego and say, would you like to come to snowy Syracuse? So again, I think that there's a variety of factors that limit that. One of the things we're looking at doing, and even our clinics don't know this yet, but we're looking at rolling out an opportunity for clinics to participate in what's known as a same-day access program, and this is something that's happening around the country. Right now, the rules are if someone leaves CPEP and CPEP makes the determination that this is an urgent referral, our clinics are obligated to see people within 5 days, and they do. The problem is they don't always see a psychiatrist within 5 days. In fact, they almost never see a psychiatrist within 5 days. So that if they need medication, you might see a social worker, you might see a psychologist. They cannot write medication prescriptions. And so, the person will be seen, but not necessarily seeing the person they need to see. And again, that relates back to the shortage of psychiatry and, quite frankly, to the expense of psychiatry relative to the finances of the clinics. But the same-day access program, which has been used successfully in other states and in other areas of New York State, really restructures the system so that people are able to access services the same day they call. And again, they may not access, they may not get immediate access to psychiatry, but it really requires a substantial restructuring of the way clinics work. So we're going to be looking in early 2014 to bring in a national expert to work with those clinics that are interested in looking at this to see if we can't implement that model locally and hopefully address some of those long waits that people have getting into care.
I'll just add to that too. Access is a huge problem and remains that, and it is related in part to underfunding of mental health care and financial viability, which is why Upstate's relied on DSH payments really to make it viable. And psychiatry is a shortage specialty. There really aren't enough psychiatrists for the demand, partly because demand has gone up and because of limitations, the cap in graduate medical education funding, there's just a limited amount of training programs generating new psychiatrists. So there's a limited pool of resources, and the question is, how can those be used most effectively? So I know Hutchings now has is really trying to get people in a walk-in kind of basis and really improve access. Both Dr. Reddy and Commissioner Long have set up programs to really try to improve access, and we have too. But there's a trade-off. Since there's a limited pool, you provide quick access to one group, it means that you have less resources for follow-up for people who are already there. So, and how to use that most efficiently is really a challenge going forward if we keep the pool of resources the same.
Can I just expand on it a little bit more? There are 20 to 30 people discharged from CPEP at any given day, and to have access the same day to our outpatient clinic is impossible, because as many get discharged from inpatient unit and as many people get discharged from med-surg floors, So it's the volume wise is we can't handle that much, so we can't see them. I mean, if they're an emergency, they need to be seen. I mean, we do make accommodations, but we also have an arm of CPAP which is called Mobile Crisis Team, where they go and see the patients who have been discharged from CPAP or inpatient between their appointments to assess if they need to be seen sooner than their appointments are scheduled. So there is a backup and there is a system which we keep track of when they get discharged from the acute care side.
Good morning. Thank you for your comments. Two things. One is, Dr. Gregory, if there's anything we can do as a community to support Upstate in maintaining the fellowship program, I would ask you to let us know that, both for the reasons Commissioner Long said in terms of keeping child psychiatrists here, but also the fellows provide a tremendous service while they're here. And the shortage of child psychiatrists is a public health emergency. I mean, it is a huge problem. So the second part of my comment I wanted to just say is, even though it is a tremendous loss to lose the children and adolescent beds from the community, it shines a light. It, you know, crisis becomes an opportunity, shines a light, as Commissioner Long said, on issues and problems, access problems, level of service problems for children and families in this community for quite a while. The Department of Mental Health has committed to an open and transparent process. I would urge people in this room to go to the New York State Office of Mental Health website, plug in Centers of Excellence, and it's a very, very user-friendly site. It's a place that says, do you want to make a comment? Please go to that site and make your comments about the kind of services. This is an opportunity which could be missed to reinvest both the personnel who aren't going to be laid off and any dollars saved to reinvest in community-based services. So I'd urge everybody to please go to that website and make your comments. We have a very brief period, just 2 months, to give input.
Great suggestion. Thank you. And, of course, working with the local representatives and state representatives is also, and federal, at the federal level, Dan Maffei, is also very important. So that's great.
I'm Andrea Wandersee. You've actually addressed a couple of my questions already in your last roundabout there, so thank you. As you're restructuring the system and how people access services, are you looking at a single point of entry, especially for children's services? They're so difficult to navigate, so difficult to find where the appropriate services are for your child, even for assertive, middle-class, educated person, let alone somebody without some of those skills.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in fact, the beginnings of a single point of entry is what led to the county thinking about reorganizing human services. The mental health system had a single point of entry for mental health services for a number of years. We have one actually for adult services and also for children's services, but it didn't include child welfare. It didn't include juvenile justice. And I don't mean, I mean, you might think, well, why would I want my child in juvenile justice? It's not juvenile justice. It's the services that juvenile justice has available or can access, which a child might need even if they aren't in the juvenile justice system. And so the first step the county took was to bring representatives from those departments together, mental health, child welfare, and juvenile justice, into what we now call the access team, and to do that in a way that it creates more of a single point of access, not just for one system, but across multiple systems. And that then led to thinking about, well, shouldn't we take this a step further and not only integrate our point of entry, but also integrate our service delivery? So the access team exists now, and we're hoping to expand that integration so that, as you said, the sort of one-stop shopping, you go to one place. Now, the other challenge, of course, is marketing that, because governments are not very good at marketing. They don't have large marketing departments or marketing budgets. As a result, you can create a single point of access, but the challenge is always how do you make sure that people who need it are able to find it and know that it exists. So,
can I just add to that, too? Sorry. The best way also is to go through your schools, because we have clinics which we work with schools. We have East Syracuse, we work with East Syracuse Minerva School District, and in the North Link area, we work with North Syracuse Cicero School Districts, and we are in one school, Porter School. I think some of the agencies have been given assignments to work with certain schools.
Right now in the Syracuse district, there are mental health clinic satellites in 23 of the 31 buildings, and we're working on getting them in all 31 buildings. And there are, other than East Syracuse, I'm trying to think, I don't think there are any in any of the suburban schools yet, but we're eventually hoping to again get more mental health services into the schools. But it's a good suggestion, because even if there isn't a mental health clinic in your child's school, the student support people there should be aware of how to access mental health services, at least to the point of connecting people with the access team. So,
recognizing that it's politically unlikely, if we went to a single-payer system in this country, how would that affect your work?
It would be much easier as far as clinical work is concerned, because we have to hire people to, I mean, I'm not sure if you understood what Bob said, the first two things, where, I mean, I don't even pay attention to those because it's too hard to understand all this Affordable Care Act, Medicaid stuff. I mean, I don't want to waste my time, but it would definitely be more productive. It will be more efficient, even in cost of running the clinics, because we don't have to have five people to try to understand what they have to do. So it definitely would make our life easier. I mean, so we don't bother about it right now because it's too hard. We have other things to do there. So we have to hire five, six people to do the billing because, I mean, they have to figure out all these codes and all the stuff, where to send each of them. So definitely it makes the practice easier, and it will be probably more, even financially more efficient to work with.
Okay. All right. We're on this side now.
Thank you for your presentation. Believing in prevention is probably a good use of resources. I wonder, as you reflect on the last 20 years, what some of the most significant advances have been technologically, pharmacologically, treatment models that are reducing some of these issues and problems that you're providing all these services for? And furthermore, what promising future do you see over the next 20 years in terms of how interventions will help those with mental illness?
Want me to start?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I mean, again, I'll start at sort of the meta level and then let my colleagues talk about some of the more specific treatment issues. I mean, I think there are a couple of things. One of them is, strangely enough, more person-centered care, which I think has been a major change, and more recovery-oriented care. You know, for a long time, the mental health system, behavioral health system really, including substance use, was very paternalistic. And I think that tended to make it more difficult, and it's difficult to engage people with substance use disorders or with mental illness, because in both cases, part, a component of the illness is denial, you know, denying that you have a problem. So there's a challenge there in the first place, but then it's even more challenging when someone meets you for the first time and you say, okay, I know what's best for you. If you just do what I tell you to, you know, and particularly that's true with young people, any of you who are parents of adolescents will understand that. And so I think, you know, the field has really shifted in its thinking to how do we engage people, recognizing that if we don't effectively engage people, we're never going to get to be able to treat them because they won't be with us in the system. So I think that's one major thing. The other major thing, I think, is the decrease in stigma associated with behavioral health conditions. And there are some excellent programs out there. Mental Health First Aid is a program that we're supporting. And our department's a national program. It's developed and run by the National Council. But it really is, if you think about, you know, Red Cross First Aid, and what do? You apply pressure to the wound and you elevate people's feet. Well, we've never in our society been open enough about mental illness to say, well, what do you do when somebody's having a nervous breakdown? What do you do when somebody's having a mental health problem? So Mental Health First Aid is a relatively brief, it's an 8-hour training program that teaches people about basic mental health conditions and also teaches people the sort of equivalent of applying pressure to the wound and elevating them in terms of how do you help people who are having a mental health crisis. So I think, you know, depression is much more openly discussed in our society and much more accepted and understood. I think there are other illnesses that are less so, that are still pretty much in the closet or poorly understood. I mean, I cringe every time I hear a TV show talk about schizophrenia as split personality, which is not what it is. So I think there's still a lot of work to be done, but I think that's on that larger level. I think those are the two things. The field developing evidence-based practices and recognizing that we need to engage people first and foremost, and then the public becoming more knowledgeable and more accepting, at least for some mental illnesses. So.
We have two early intervention therapists. One of them goes to all our clinics and the wellness well visits with the kids. They do the screening every year. And also there's the other person who goes to the schools at the request of the schools to screen for them in elementary school level to identify high-risk kids, and they get treatment in the community or they'll be admitted to our clinic if they need to be. But with the new integration with adult children and psychiatry, I think it'll become much easier and more acceptable, and I think we can identify them early enough so that we can do some interventions and help them not to get so chronic.
Of course, I always have a kind of a negative tilt to things, but I think a lot of our research efforts in the past couple of decades have really not panned out very much, to be honest. The 1990s was the decade of the brain. It was supposed to be, and billions of dollars were put into pharmacology research and looking at different receptors in the brain and from a pharmacological level. And we did learn a lot. But I don't think there really been a lot of major breakthroughs in terms of the medication end in the last 20 years. There are a lot of new medications, and most of the research funded by pharmaceutical companies, either alone or in partnership with NIMH. Some of our medications have less side effects, and that's helpful, and it's good to have choices, but really not a lot of breakthroughs in medication, despite the billions and billions of dollars spent on that. With the advertising as well, and the way medical education is funded through pharmaceutical companies, there's a great emphasis in the medical system of finding the right pill. And I think even as consumers, that's what we hear about, you know, finding the right medication to solve our mental problems. And it's not always the best solution. More quietly, and actually mostly out of the United States, because the United States really doesn't fund psychotherapy research anymore, but other countries do, and there's been a lot of exciting findings, really, with psychotherapy, new treatments being developed. One of them actually developed at Upstate. And so a number of evidence-based treatments developing and refinements to those treatments that are being implemented more and more in the community, and I think that's been positive. We've also, there's been some very interesting research in early attachment, and finding that in terms of prevention, finding that that's really, really important for future mental health. So, for instance, mother-child bonding, if there's a postpartum depression, so which is pretty common that women will get depressed after childbirth because of the hormonal changes. And that can have impact on the bonding between mother and child and actually a long-term impact on the mental health of that child. We don't really have good models to intervene. There's been some research in pre-K programs actually being able to help with some of the early environmental problems with bonding or deprivation other ways, and actually reversing some of those detrimental changes and restoring mental health over long term, 20 years follow-up. So there are things we can do very early on. We just don't have billing or delivery models, financing, to be able to intervene like that and work with mother and infants to improve that relationship and really be very aggressive. We really need to be very aggressive at a very early age, and that's something we can do. There's a lot of research now in genetics. It's and that's really the main focus now of NIMH. Almost all its resources are going into genetics research, and there is some hope around that. We don't know how much that's panned out. I mean, the hope is that we can find biomarkers of different illnesses and take a blood test, find the genetics of that person, then be able to target treatment. Usually, it's pharmacological people have in mind for that. Whether that will pan out and actually turn into useful treatments is very unclear at this point. And a lot of the geneticists are actually very skeptical about that because there are so many steps in between the gene and the final expression of behavior or illness. To end on a more positive note, another really exciting development, I think, is neuroscience. So really outside of medicine and outside of psychiatry, there's been research being done by neuroscientists, and we're learning, focusing on neural pathways, and we're learning a lot about how the brain functions in different regions that are involved. And I actually see this as an untapped area, that there are interventions we can do to enhance those neural pathways, just like physical therapy, occupational therapy, can enhance neural pathways, motor pathways after a stroke, right? So we have a program. There's no medication that can reverse a stroke after it's established. I mean, you can try to break up the clot with different agents, but once it's established, then there's no medication that can help with that. But there is, they can get involved in physical therapy, occupational therapy, and through repeated use of these different parts, it can actually regrow new motor neuron pathways and restore functioning either completely or partially to the brain. And it's through that remediation, that neural remediation. And one of the really exciting developments has been cognitive remediation for schizophrenia, and finding that through either computer or assisted computer kind of training and practicing certain functions which have been lost through the illness, they can actually restore a lot of those functions and improve not only symptoms but actually help people to get to a better level, have global changes in functioning. At Upstate, we're doing some similar kind of research with borderline personality disorder and trying to restore neural pathways through using some of these the latest neuroscience research. And again, it's an area that isn't funded very easily because it's not in our mind. It's a different way of approaching problems than what we're used to. But I think that's a very promising area in the future.
I was happy to hear you say Commissioner Long. I was going to say Bob, but that would have been confusing there. That some of the stigma attached to mental illness has been reduced, because certainly that's something that we talked about 10 years ago, even that was critical at that point. And a recognition that mental illness encompasses not just those very, the awful emergencies and inpatients and the stories that we hear in the media all the time, but also people who are walking around. And I just have to add this, that it was two nights ago, coincidentally, I was pulling into my driveway and there was a woman at my neighbor's door ringing the doorbell, and when she saw me, she walked up my driveway, and it was a middle-aged woman, slightly disheveled looking, I would say, but carrying a big pink bag, and I couldn't help notice her T-shirt, which said, "Being normal is boring." And after a few minutes conversation with her, she was a little bit distressed because she was and confused. It was clear to me that she was not, I don't know if it's politically correct to say normal, but she probably was involved in some kind of mental health issue. And, we had a conversation. I tried to assure her, and she, wound up just kind of turning around and walking away. She was, physically very able, but I kept thinking, should I have done something? I mean, you know, if I had seen someone with a broken arm, or I would have known what to do, but I didn't know what to do. So although we're more accepting, I still think we don't know, in some cases, what should we do? Should we do anything? There is still a lot of sensitivity and awareness and education that's needed, and appreciate everything that you all do. I know we have a million more questions. We'll have to have another program, and even to touch on the whole Justice Center and that issue again. So again, thank you, Commissioner Long, Dr. Reddy, Dr. Gregory.